So good morning, everyone, and welcome to our conference commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Loving versus Virginia case. My name is Carrie Abrams. I am the Vice Provost for Faculty Affairs at the university and a professor in the law school. Our dean, Risa Goluboff, was at the last minute unable to give the introduction today, so I will be doing it on her behalf. About a year and a half ago, my colleague Angela Onwuachi-Willig from the University of California, Berkeley, who's over here, emailed me and said, "What is the University of Virginia doing to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Loving case?" And I wrote back, "I have no idea." So I asked around and then wrote back, "Nothing. We should do something." And then she gave me a full-blown symposium proposal that she had already written, including the names of people she wanted to invite to speak. And so we approached the Journal of Social Policy and the Law, and they enthusiastically agreed to publish the papers and help us plan the symposium, and now here we are. So I want to thank Professor Onwuachi-Willig for kicking us into gear here, and also the many, many people who helped make this symposium possible. Ali Herzog, who is the editor-in-chief of the journal, Natalie Abshez and Jerry Brown, who are the editors who are handling the symposium, have all done a fantastic job planning all of the logistics for this and will be coordinating the editorial process for the papers that will come out of it. Kate Duvall, the director of student affairs, nudged us in the right direction at every turn. And then, of course, facilities management, IT, and communications all played very important roles in getting us here today. So thank you to all of you. We also got funding, of course, so I want to thank the Dean's Office and the Intellectual Life Fund, the Journal's Symposium Fund, the Department of English, which kicked in a very important piece, which was pizza at the film last night, which drew 70 undergraduates to the film that we screened, as well as the Vice Provost for the Arts for helping us get the rights to the film and purchasing that, and then the Minority Rights Coalition students on Main Grounds for getting out information about the conference broadly. I also want to thank someone who's not here, but I think can help us understand why publishing academic papers about something can be an important civil rights activity, and that is Walter Wadlington. Walter is a professor emeritus at the University of Virginia, and he came to our faculty in the 1960s. He wrote a law review article in the Virginia Law Review that was then cited in the Loving decision, and giving the court some of the architecture for thinking about why Virginia's interracial marriage ban might be unconstitutional. And I called him and spoke to him and his wife, and he was unable to come today, but knows about the conference and was really, really happy that we were having it. When I presented a talk to our alums a few years ago and mentioned Walter's work, several African-American alums who were the earliest African-Americans to graduate from the university came up to me and said, "You know, Walter was the person who made us feel that it was okay that we were here. He included us, he called on us, he treated us the same as the white students. Not all of the faculty did that." And so I think all of us need to think not only about civil rights lawyers that bring big cases, but also the difference that scholarship can make in influencing the court, and the difference that professors can make in the classroom with their students, and Walter is a wonderful, wonderful example of that. yesterday, some of you were here to hear Dean Erwin Chemerinsky's keynote talk, and I wanted to kick off our conference by referring to the analysis that he gave us of the case, because I think it can help us think through the issues that we're going to explore in more depth today. So he talked about the Loving decision as both a triumph and a failure. He said it was a triumph because it rejected a formal equality approach to race discrimination. You may remember he mentioned that the argument the state of Virginia was making was that this statute discriminates equally against whites and people of color. They can't marry each other, but they can marry within their own group, so there's no discrimination. And in favor instead of an anti-subordination approach. And so Loving was a case that actually used the words white supremacy to describe the purpose behind the Virginia statute in striking it down. And Dean Chemerinsky saw that as a triumph of the case. He also pointed out that it's a case that established that marriage is a fundamental right, and created a new right that was not textually enumerated in the Constitution, and that then caused other fundamental rights to proliferate in the court, and saw that as a triumph. As a failure, he saw the lateness of the case, 1967, and he spent a lot of time explaining to us how the court had had other opportunities to strike down these laws and had not taken those opportunities. So today, I think we're going to have an opportunity to think about these triumphs and failures in more depth. Some of the panelists will be looking at the history of the case with more nuance, and we will be able to further examine these claims about whether the case was a triumph or a failure or both. And then many of the panels will be thinking about the implications of the case for today. So one question I want to put before you is, how effective has Loving been as a vehicle for thinking about different types of civil rights? How effective has the anti-subordination framework how effective has it been, and how much has the court actually used it? And then in what other contexts has the case been useful? There are two obvious areas that I think we'll spend quite a bit of time on, and one is race discrimination and the other is marriage rights more broadly. So as Dean Chemerinsky mentioned, Loving is the case that was cited in almost every marriage equality case from Goodridge to the more recent Obergefell, and provided the framework for thinking about marriage as a fundamental right. And so we will be considering that in our panels today. So without further ado, I'd like to get our first panel going. And our first panel, I will let the moderator introduce the panel. But our first panel is about Loving's meaning thinking about some of the history of the case and what it means for us today. And our moderator is Dana Bowen Matthew. Dana rejoined our faculty this fall, and we are so, so delighted that she is back with us. She was gone for a long, long time, having a very illustrious career in both legal academia and public policy. She really, more than anyone I know, has gone back and forth between academics, private practice, and public service, and has had a especially big impact in healthcare disparities law. And so, Professor Matthew, why you come up and introduce your panel.
Thank you. Panel? So I am relatively new again to the University of Virginia, and those who have me in class know I speak fast and I speak loudly, and I apologize in advance for that, but you'll hear very little of me and more of my panelists today. We're going to talk about Loving's meaning. My introduction is going to be very brief, and I'm going to leave most of the time for the panelists. Let me say, though, that if you are interested in something that is timely, that is relevant, that is powerful, that is informative, and that is moving, that will be our panel. I've heard lots about what they're going to say, and even more about what they've written. Let me start by saying that this is a subject on the rise. The Pew Foundation reported that in 1967, when the United States Supreme Court decided what Professor Kennedy calls the most aptly named case in all of American constitutional history, Loving versus the Commonwealth of Virginia, and declared unconstitutional the multitude of miscegenation laws throughout the United States, only 3% of all newlyweds were married to someone of a different race. That was back in 1967. Since then, intermarriage rates have steadily climbed. By 1980, the share of intermarried newlyweds had about doubled to 7%, and by 2015, the number had risen to 17%. That year, more than 670,000 newlyweds entered into marriages with someone of different race or ethnicity. That was the first year, 1980, that data was collected, and so now we have doubled. So we are into a growth industry today. I am going to say just a word, and I do mean literally a word, about each of the panelists. They are described in all of their accomplishments in the brochure. I recommend that to your reading. No one on this panel is unknown to you. And so in preparing, not to be reductionist, but just to let you know that this is going to be an emotional topic as well as an informative and intellectual one,
In reading their materials for each one, there was a word that described the emotion, that prioritized their writing. And I'm just going to introduce them by letting them know what that word is. And that's the word that I will say about each of these panelists, and then they will follow. So Professor Frankie, who will be our first speaker, she is the author of the new book, Wedlot, which I highly recommend, and another book that's coming out, Repair, Slavery's Unfinished Business. And your word is supreme. It made me feel, when you have challenged us about the myth and indeed the lie of white supremacy in a deeply nuanced and profound way. You've gone beyond that. I love your opinion in Obergefell versus Hodges as justice, Frankie. And you wrote there that the ban on same-sex marriage is best understood as a measure designed to maintain heterosexual supremacy and to inflict a badge of inferiority on sexual minorities generally, and on lesbians and gay men particularly. I will look forward to hearing more about that in your remarks. Professor Kennedy, you have inspired me to resist. That's the word that came up in your reading and writing for me. You will challenge us to think about where and why resistance does appear and when it does not. Interracial intimacy, you have told us, was not resisted by the time the Supreme Court decision was decided. But in popular culture, there is resistance emerging in very different kinds of patterns and ways, and we'll look forward to hearing that. Professor Lenhart, dignity was the word that came to mind and rose. You are the author of so many things on this subject. It was hard for me to keep up. Black citizenship through marriage, black marriage as citizens, marriage as black citizenship, race dignity, and the right to marriage. According to our heart, so many writings I can't list. But I thought that the argument for non-marriage was an argument about dignity. And I really look forward to hearing more about that. So the format will be that each speaker will speak for between 15 and 20 minutes. I won't say any more to introduce them in between. We'll reserve all questions for the end. I'll keep a queue, and I look forward to Professor Frankie kicking us off.
Thank you so much. That's such an interesting device to use as an introduction, so I have since then rewritten my remarks so that they're consonant with the term supreme, although I might have picked supremacy, but supreme is beautiful too. So thank you, Dana, for that introduction. I want to thank Dean Golubov for just basically everything. She's an incredible dean. You're so lucky to have a dean like her here, and to support this kind of conference is wonderful. Carrie, picking up on Angela's idea and running with it and having us here, and then Allie and the journal for ultimately publishing our papers and supporting this work, and then Natalia for getting us all here in one piece. So as you all are very aware, on June 12th, 1967, Chief Justice Earl Warren announced for a unanimous Supreme Court that Virginia's statute criminalizing marriage between white persons and colored persons violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, not only because the statute made criminality of an act depend on the race of one of the members of the couple, but because such measures were designed to maintain white supremacy. That notion, white supremacy, was not argued to the court in Loving by the parties, though the term was used by the Japanese American Citizens League in their amicus brief just once and was mentioned by their advocate during an oral argument. One of Loving's lawyers did argue that to the court that this is a slavery law, pure and simple. A different concept, I think, than white supremacy, but certainly not unrelated. And the court was certainly aware, however, that the Commonwealth's lawyers had defended their anti-miscegenation statute on starkly eugenicist grounds 10 years earlier in the Name case, maintaining that the legitimate purpose underlying the statute, or purposes, were to preserve the racial integrity of its citizens, to prevent the corruption of blood, to prevent a mongrel breed of citizens and the obliteration of white people, along with racial pride. As we all know, the Loving decision was the first and only time that the U.S. Supreme Court acknowledged that white supremacy played a role in American society, much less served as a justification for invalidating a statute for its role in maintaining the supremacy of white people. No mention of white supremacy when the court struck down Jim Crow segregation laws in Brown, only in Loving. So why with respect to interracial marriage, and why in 1967? Surely the nasty work of white supremacy can be found in contexts other than interracial marriage, and surely its nomination for condemnation by the Supreme Court in 67 did not retire its ongoing power to structure American society, even today. Now, it's worth noting that the provision of the law that criminalized Mildred and Richard Loving's marriage was part of a larger nativist-driven legislative effort that gained enormous success in the Virginia legislature in 1924, one that not only tightened up the Commonwealth's longstanding prohibition on marriage by white people to non-white people, but also required all citizens within the state born after June and 1912 to register their racial composition with the Bureau of Vital Statistics, and the statute also defined what exactly qualified as white. A companion bill passed on the same day as the anti-miscegenation statute mandated the sexual sterilization of inmates in state institutions deemed to be, in the terms of the statute, feeble-minded, including the insane, idiotic, imbecilic, or epileptic, to use the terms of the statute. In this regard, I think Virginia established itself as the successful testing ground for the implementation of Harry Laughlin's model eugenical sterilization law. So while the interracial marriage provisions of the Virginia law, as we all know, were invalidated by the court in the Loving case, the court upheld the constitutionality of the mandatory sterilization provisions in 1927 in Buck versus Bell, a ruling which many of us feel compelled to note time and again is still good law. So one way of understanding the court's willingness to acknowledge white supremacy in Loving was that Loving came in what we might call as the twilight of de jure Jim Crow. Loving was decided in the late 60s at the tail end of the second civil rights revolution, more as a coda to the end of an era, kind of cleanup operation. The court's invocation of white supremacy capitalizing both words, as Robin Lenhart has noted in her incredibly important scholarship on Perez and Loving, it worked as a kind of indexical gesture backwards to a now repudiated time. As Julie Novkov has noted, the ruling finalized the United States' transition to what David Goldberg calls the modern racial state, which situates state-sponsored discrimination as a historically transcended phenomenon while jealously conserving broad scope for private racial expression and discrimination. One might ask whether the invocation of white supremacy by the court in Loving was at bottom an admonishing gesture towards the past that had the felicitous and indeed intended effect of exonerating the present being 1967. If there's any truth in this supposition, then it might explain why no member of the court could nor would have used the term in characterizing the structural work done by practices that violated the Equal Protection Clause in 1886 in Yickwo versus Hopkins, 1896 in Plessy versus Ferguson, 1946 in Shelley versus Kramer, or 1950 in Sweat versus Painter. In this regard, Loving established a pivotal transition in the court's equal protection jurisprudence, investing longer term in a more benign anti-classification rather than anti-subordination model of equality, as Dan and others have noticed. It seems that structural power, once acknowledged expressly by the state's highest court, need never be mentioned again not because uttering its name has the profound performative effect of destroying it, would that that were the case, but rather because it contained it in its juridical relevance to the past. So what ongoing utility as a mode of legal analysis might the notion of white supremacy have for us as scholars and advocates today? Overall, or after all, we continue to live in a society that is essentially structured by forms of racial prejudice and disadvantage and privilege. And we have a Supreme Court that cares more about classification than power, formalism than structure. Indeed, the marvelous judge, Shira Scheindlin, did not invoke white supremacy when she described in painstaking detail how and why the New York Police Department's stop and frisk policy violated the equal protection rights of African American New Yorkers. So at the same time that the Supreme Court has committed itself to a view of the Constitution that renders structural power illegible, the federal government has inaugurated a renaissance of public policies resting almost entirely on the explicit desire to fortify, if not at the same time rehabilitate, a range of odious power structures, and perhaps even the notion of caste. Much, though not all, of those structures are racially inflected. Indeed, appeals to racial stereotypes and nativist fears have emerged, I think, as the lingua franca of the current administration. So I just want to show a quick 30-second clip. I know you guys have set it up for me, and then reflect on that for a second.
That's illegal immigrant Luis Bracamontes, charged with murdering two police officers.
I wish I could kill more of those motherfuckers.
It's pure evil. President Trump is right. Build the wall. Deport criminals. Stop illegal immigration now. Democrats who stand in our way will be complicit in every murder committed by illegal immigrants. President Trump will fix our border and keep our families safe.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
So as the Senate was holding up the approval of a budget, we had a so-called government shutdown last weekend, this is what the White House released. This is how they spoke to this moment, as the Democrats were insisting on some legalization of Dreamers or DACA eligible members of our community. So to the extent that you would agree with me that the work done and the viewpoints expressed by this video raise serious constitutional questions, would we be best served by characterizing the video as expressing or maintaining white supremacy? Put another way, does the reasoning of Loving versus Virginia provide a useful analytic tool for articulating a constitutional objection to policies of this current federal executive? To metabolize this time we're in, what analytic tools should we turn? Or should we turn to? Frantz Fanon's notion of negritude, Stuart Hall's notion of societies structured in dominance, Etienne Balibar's concept of crisis racism, Nietzsche's will to power, Carl Schmitt's state of exception, or out of desperation, perhaps Hobbes and his state of nature. After all, force and fraud for Hobbes are the resources of survival in the absence of state control. But what are we to say about a state that takes up force and fraud as its primary modes of governance? Comfort and control have been the elixirs of liberal government. Comfort is a form of control, and social control is the underpinnings of social comfort. But when the liberal state begins to dissolve, not into a state of nature, but into a state that trades almost exclusively in force and fraud, notions of belonging, security, and responsibility begin to dissolve along with it. Now, race has become the circuitry that renders possible, I think, the devolution of a liberal state of comfort and control into one of force and fraud. That racial circuitry isn't only about the subordination or disenfranchisement of non-white members of the polity, but about the celebration of a kind of racial homogeneity that becomes the horizon for a state that acts in the name of a recuperated greatness for and about us, the us being the citizenry conjured by the video we just watched, and the core base of the current administration, a white base. The exercise of police authority or public authority for this kind of state is, to be sure, a postmodern, post-liberal form of biogovernance. Recall Fanon's powerful exposition of that moment on the street when a young white child points at him and says, "Maman, a Negro, I'm afraid." Yet in our current predicament, it's the state that is pointing at a Negro, a Muslim, a Mexican, and declaring, "We should be afraid." That's what that video is doing. So the tools of this racial state are not limited to the ordering and management of racialized bodies, such as the work of Virginia's Act to Preserve Racial Integrity. Loving in Virginia, after all, addressed the constitutionality of a statute that sought to preserve racial purity in the corporal bodies, physical bodies of its citizenry. The Constitution ruled the court could not accommodate blatant forms of racialization designed to protect the purity of those white bodies. But today, it's not just the purity of white human bodies that the state is concerned about, as it was in the enactment of the anti-miscegenation laws. It's a public body. The racialized body of the nation itself must be defended. So today, in a way, I don't think we can say, I don't think we can say about the era in which Loving was decided that the racial state is fueled by, or at least gains a motivation. Oh, I screwed this up. Today's racial state, in contrast to Loving's racial state, is motivated by a kind of death drive. Loving's use of the notion of white supremacy was rejuvenating in nature. It had a quality to it that cleansed and redeemed the past and, by implication, the future. By contrast, today's racial state is more, I think, necrotic in nature, largely because it sees itself as less responsible for mature governance and more responsible for advancing the interests of a racialized nation at the expense of a racialized state. Whether it's Betsy DeVos's efforts to dismantle the very idea of public schools, what they now term government schools, or the underpinnings of the newly passed tax bill, the government is officially committed to the idea of a withering state in the name of protecting a strong nation, both of which are saliently racialized. The state, as framed by the current ruling ideology, is a tool that serves them and needs to be dismantled. Them are the DACA beneficiaries, the people receiving public benefits, black welfare recipients. Recall that Trump thought all people on welfare were black. Yet, and here lies its necropolitical impulse. The state as we know it today is fully in the hands of white supremacists, not in the hands of people of color. They, the white supremacists, control all three branches of the government. So while the state is conjured as something that serves the interests of the colored, disadvantaged masses, in reality, it quite clearly has become a site of capital extraction for the white super wealthy micro minority. By contrast, the nation, not the state, but the nation, is imagined as hardworking white Americans who are threatened and burdened by the idea of a colored state. The social identity of the state and the nation in this sense are distinctly racialized, the state as of color and the nation as white. Surely no coincidence, we might note, after the first black president. So while what's incredible, I think, for most of us to watch is that the fact that, is this fact that all of this is taking place explicitly in the open. Yet its obviousness seems not to provide even the slightest impetus for slowing it down or its destruction, actually quite the contrary. So perhaps this is what white supremacy looks like in the era of Trump. the supremacy of a great white nation over a degenerate colored state. It is a condition in which the state becomes the tool by which a white minority can pull off the ordering of a racialized national character. Chief Justice Warren and Loving invoked the evil of white supremacy as an act that simultaneously disavowed the past and redeemed the present, calling out white supremacist structure that was affirmatively maintained by forms of state power, such as anti-miscegenation laws, was possible because of its location in the rear view mirror of history. But in a period such as the one we're living through today, where the racial state is gaining, not losing momentum, the Supreme Court is less likely, I think, to label state policies as white supremacist in nature, because to do so would be to interject itself in a war of wills with another branch of government that has far more and far more effective tools at its disposal to bring into being a world that it has promised to its base. Perhaps Loving versus Virginia teaches us how the Supreme Court can be most bold when the stakes are particularly low. Where, if not to the Supreme Court, then should we look at a time like the present when we need a powerful counterforce to the illiberal state? Loving teaches us once again that the best check on force and fraud is the people, not the government. Thank you.
As Professor Kennedy comes to the microphone, I will stand corrected as well. Supremacy is the right word. And you just told us to be afraid or concerned or resist the supremacy of a great white nation in the face of a degenerative colored state. That's powerful. Thank you.
Thank you very much for providing this forum for all of us. I'd like to express my deep gratitude for everyone who has played a role in facilitating this wonderful symposium. I'm going to focus our attention for a few minutes on the following question. Why wasn't there more opposition to Loving versus Virginia? Loving versus Virginia did not trigger massive resistance. In 1954, when the Supreme Court of the United States invalidated de jure segregation in public primary and secondary education, that triggered a huge response at various levels. It triggered violence. Think of Aaron versus Cooper and the Little Rock crisis, or the desegregation crisis at Ole Miss with Meredith versus Fair, James Meredith, seeking to desegregate the University of Mississippi. It triggered opposition at the highest levels of government. Think of the Southern Manifesto, in which virtually all, not all, but virtually all of the representatives from the southern states and the senators from the southern states formally criticized, they didn't just criticize, they vilified the Supreme Court of the United States and said that the Supreme Court of the United States had been acting in a illicit way. Right here in Virginia, in Prince Edward County, schools were shut down for 5 years, just no public schools. We'd rather have no public education than desegregated public education. With Brown versus Board of Education, there was a very intense, very strong, very public, and ongoing resistance at wide variety of levels. Loving versus Virginia, very different story. After 1967, after the ruling in 1967, was there some resistance? Yeah, there was some resistance. Every now and again, there would be some local official who would resist giving a mixed couple a wedding license. But when that happened, and that, by the way, that didn't happen very often, but when that happened, such efforts at resistance would quickly be squelched. Either state courts or federal courts would be petitioned, and they would quickly overrule the decision of the local official. And what's so really striking about the aftermath of Loving versus Virginia is that not much happened. Now, why do I find this worth talking about? I find this worth talking about because of the importance of anti-miscegenation laws. As Dean Chemerinsky pointed out in his wonderful remarks yesterday, the laws prohibiting marriage across the race line are among the oldest racial regulations in the United States, going back to the 17th century. So not only are they old, not only do they have this long tradition, but they've been deeply important. If one thinks about the first Reconstruction, if one takes a look at the debates that accompanied the 13th Amendment, if one takes a look at the debates that accompanied the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the nation's first federal civil rights statute, if one takes a look at the debates surrounding the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, frankly, during the first Reconstruction, if one takes a look at any advance with respect to the race question, the issue of marriage was front and center, with the opponents to all of these advances saying over and over and over again, what will this mean for marriage? Marriage was the specter of interracial marriage was the big boogeyman. And it was used as an effort to embarrass racial reformers. It was viewed as a way of putting them in their place. And indeed, racial reformers were very attentive to this. During the debates over the 14th Amendment, when this issue arose, when the opponents of the 14th Amendment said, gosh, you know, this 14th Amendment, what is this going to mean for intermarriage? Or what is this going to mean for the prohibition against intermarriage? The principal framers of the 14th Amendment sidestepped that and said, actually, the 14th Amendment won't mean any, the 14th Amendment will not mean the death, will not require the abolition of anti-miscegenation laws. Because after all, if a law prohibits white people from marrying colored people, and a law prohibits colored people from marrying white people, everybody's being treated equally. The framers of the 14th Amendment actually would have been in agreement with the notion of equality that was actually overruled by the Supreme Court in Loving versus Virginia. If you are an originalist, Loving versus Virginia is wrong. But to get back to my main point, anti-miscegenation laws are so important. Listen to Gunnar Myrdal in 1944 in his great An American Dilemma. Quote, "The ban on intermarriage has the highest place in the white man's rank order of social segregation and discrimination. Sexual segregation is the most pervasive form of segregation, and the concern about race purity is basic. No other way of crossing the color line is so attended by the emotion commonly associated with violating a social taboo as intermarriage and extramarital relations between a Negro man and a white woman." all of the Jim Crow provisions were defended in part as ways to interdict interracial marriage. And if you think about, again, if we go back to schooling, the idea was, well, if you have schools in which kids of different races go to school together, if you have, you know, Black Sam and White Sally in kindergarten together, what the heck? By 12th grade, they might be thinking about marriage. With respect to juries, with respect to voting, with respect to housing, with respect to virtually everything, the champions of racial exclusion, the champions of racial discrimination, the champions of white supremacy, over and over and over again, defended their project largely in terms of race purity, largely in terms of staving off the great threat being racial intermarriage. So again, why, when the Supreme Court makes its ruling in 1967, why wasn't there more resistance? Well, a couple of possibilities come to mind. One is that a lot had, by 1967, much had happened. I mean, after all, 19 years before, the California Supreme Court in Perez versus Sharp had invalidated California's anti-miscegenation law. That's an important point. Again, Dean Chemerinsky mentioned that. No one has spoken about Perez with more knowledge and more movingly than my colleague Robin Linhart. But Perez, very important case, 19 years before Loving versus Virginia. So 19 years before the Supreme Court got around to it, the California courts got around to striking down the California anti-miscegenation law. So courts, again, the California court was an outlier. But nonetheless, you start seeing courts getting into the act. Then, of course, 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, Supreme Court of the United States, strikes down racial segregation in schooling. And then in subsequent cases, Brown versus Board of Education is enlarged. De jure segregation is invalidated with respect to beaches, with respect to swimming pools, with respect to graveyards, with respect to buses. So that's putting more and more pressure. That's undermining the basis for anti-miscegenation laws. You also have state legislatures. In 1948, there were 30 states that prohibited marriage across the race line. By 1967, that number had shrunk to just 16. So by the time the Supreme Court of the United States confronts the issue, anti-miscegenation laws have really shrunk. It's only in the former Confederacy that you have anti-miscegenation laws. So it's from the point of view of the Supreme Court, it's a considerably more manageable task. What else is going on? Well, you have popular culture. In our subject, this question of anti-miscegenation laws, you know, Loving versus Virginia, very important. But you also have another development in the realm of popular culture that's important. You have Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? You know, Sidney Poitier. Sidney Poitier is on, you know, in theaters all around the United States as a world-famous physician about to marry a young white woman. Now, I think nowadays people looking at Guess Who's Coming to Dinner would maybe chuckle. I don't know, I saw it a little while ago. It seemed, you know, fairly boring to me. You have this couple about to become married, and in 1967, all that Hollywood is willing to put on screen is a very chaste kiss seen in the mirror of a cab. Not much erotic sizzle there. But nonetheless, Hollywood is doing its thing, and that's helping with the struggle. Then you have the Civil Rights Movement. Now, the Civil Rights Movement is an interesting thing here. The Civil Rights Movement never made anti-miscegenation laws or attacks on anti-miscegenation laws an important part of its mission. Never did the NAACP have rallies attacking anti-miscegenation laws. You did not have marches demanding the end of anti-miscegenation laws. Now, ironically, this may have something to do with why there was not big, massive resistance to Loving versus Virginia, because insofar as the Civil Rights Movement never made the destruction of anti-miscegenation laws a conspicuous, a prominent, a salient part of its mission, it lowered the visibility of anti-miscegenation laws and maybe made anti-miscegenation laws a less attractive subject for counter-mobilization. In any event, what we face in looking at Loving versus Virginia is, as was suggested earlier, largely a cleanup operation that did not have really much of a knock-on effect insofar as the ongoing attack against white supremacy in law in the United States. Rather, after Loving versus Virginia, its most important function has been in other domains, most importantly, the effort to allow people to marry freely regardless of sexual orientation, regardless of gender. In this sense, Loving is rather ambiguous in its meaning. It certainly is an attack on white supremacy, as we've heard. On the other hand, it does only stand for freedom of choice. Nobody is required to marry across the race line. And like I said, probably nowadays its most important function is not in the realm of race, but in other realms as well. Those have, very important in our legal universe. I feel very grateful for the role that Loving versus Virginia is playing in these other realms. But in the overall scheme of things for race relations law, though Loving versus Virginia is obviously very important, obviously a landmark, it would be a mistake to exaggerate its importance. On that note, I'll subside. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Kennedy, for reminding us of the importance that Loving is playing in other realms, but not in the dismantling of white supremacy in our law. Thank you very much. That was very helpful and powerful as well.
Good morning. I feel like it's afternoon because I've been up since early on. I also want to join my fellow panelists in thanking the administration, the Law Review, all of you in the audience for being here today and making this event possible. I also want to thank my panelists and moderator for their comments, and just to say how honored I am to be part of this particular conversation with all of you. Last summer, Brent Staples wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and it was entitled, "What if the court in the Loving case had declared race a false idea?" Now, in it, he argued the following. He said, had the court taken that approach, the Loving decision might well have been a more enduring strike against white supremacy and changed the way the country talks about race. So this morning, I want to explore this claim. I want to try to understand it and see if it has the legs that Staples suggests, to ask whether the court's failure to take that particular path means that we should be loving a little less or not. So Staples' intervention really seems to have been inspired by, and to begin with, at least in part, some engagement with social science research. The extensive research that existed at the time of Loving, produced by the Gunnar Myrdals of the world, but also Franz Boas, an important anthropologist, and others. That work combined expressed the view, reached the conclusion that biologized race was a fallacy, a social construction, a lie. Now, in my work, I've been interested in the role that that research has played in courts. Boas and his contemporaries took their research about race, about the lie of race, directly to the courts. They were intentional in serving as expert witnesses, providing support to cases brought by people all over the country, big and small matters. Restrictive covenant cases, for example. There's a case called Ridgway versus Cockburn that I've looked at, in which it's a racial case involving a racially restrictive covenant, and the defendants in that case, a black couple in the eyes of the court, challenged the idea that they could be designated, or at least that the wife could be designated as Negroes under the statute. Interracial marriage cases, will contests that were ultimately also about anti-miscegenation provisions. All of these interventions, cases designed to underscore the illegitimacy of race. Now, the case in which this notion of race as uncertainty, as vague in a way that is constitutionally problematic, is really Perez versus Sharp, the case that Dean Chemerinsky talked about yesterday. That is, Perez was the first post-Reconstruction case to invalidate an anti-miscegenation provision. Its heroes, my heroes, are Sylvester Davis and Andrea Perez, an African-American man and a Mexican-American woman, who under the California provisions at issue, which prevented Mongolians, this is a quote, Malay, mulattoes, and then Negroes from marrying whites. So for the purpose of a provision, Andrea was regarded as white and not as Mexican-American. That case, in lots of ways, was the pathway to the Loving decision. It regarded marriage as a fundamental right, but it also did something more than that, and I want to share some things, some quotes from the opinion, and maybe even the oral argument in that case to help you see why it was important. First, I'll just note before I get there that something, and I don't think this was mentioned yesterday, the Perez case was important not only for Loving and how we think about interracial marriage, it was played a fundamental role in equal marriage litigation. So litigation to secure the right to marry for LGBTQ individuals. And for good reason. At one point in the opinion, Chief Justice Traynor, for those law students in the room, you may remember the name Traynor from torts. He is the king of torts, but in Perez, he's also the king of marriage and love and dignity. And he says at one point in his opinion, striking down the California provision, he uses this language, and this got repeated over and over and over again in equal marriage litigation. He said, a person consigned to segregated facilities might still ride in a railway car or be educated in public schools, right? And using that language, he has to contend with the problem that he had that the Loving Court did not have, which was that Brown versus Board of Education had not been decided in 1948, right? So separate but equal was the law. So he had to find a way to get around that. So he says, it may be that you can equalize subway cars. But he says, but for the individual prevented by law from marrying the person of his choice, that person to him may be irreplaceable. So that was his very good and very useful for later litigation effort to get around separate but equal. But he didn't stop there. He went on to talk about the inherent instability of the racial categories that California had enshrined in its anti-miscegenation law and that were being used by other states as well. In his actual opinion, he explores that by addressing what for him he saw as a problem for California. I think it's something that we continue to grapple with today, which what's the status of mixed race individuals? Right? For anti-miscegenation law, they were troubled because they revealed that the categories themselves were not actually as stable as states like Virginia wanted them to be. Traynor referenced this social science research that I mentioned during oral argument, and I'll just give you a taste of it because it's really wonderful. He says to the state's lawyer, what is a Negro, Mr. Stanley? We have not the benefit of any judicial interpretation. The statute states that a Negro cannot marry a Negro, which can be construed to mean a full-blooded Negro, since the statute also says mulatto, Mongolian, or Malay. Traynor, what is a mulatto? A 1/16th blood? Stanley, not getting it, continues. And Traynor says, if there's 1/8th blood, can you marry? If you can marry with 1/8th, why not 1/16th, 1/32nd, 1/64th? And then don't you get into the ridiculous position where a Negro cannot marry anybody? If he is white, he cannot marry black. Or if he is black, he cannot marry white. Professor Chemerinsky, again, noted that this opinion was so important for Loving. I think it's also important for our discussion of Loving because of that passage and others in the opinion and other statements that Traynor makes. How do we think about the uncertainty of race in this context? You should know that Chief Justice Warren knew about Perez. He was governor of the state of California when the case came down, and he cites it in a footnote in Loving. Arguments about the vagueness of race had, of course, been mentioned and utilized by litigants in the McLaughlin case. The court declined to engage that. And there was an extensive colloquy, as Professor Franke mentioned, around the issue of race and racial vagueness in the Loving case with William Aratani, who's the legal counsel for the Japanese American Citizens League, who were amici. But I'll just point out that we don't see in the opinion any evidence of Warren trying to grapple with this, but he does actually invoke this social science research in oral argument. So he says to the state's lawyer, reading from a passage from the UNESCO report that was very important at the time, "It seems to me that the last paragraph of the report is rather definite. It isn't general in any sense. It said, quote, the biological data given above stand on an open contradiction to the tenets of racism. Racist theories can in no way pretend to have any scientific foundation, and the anthropologist should endeavor to prevent the results of their research from being used in such a biased way." He says, that seems pretty definite to me. But the Loving opinion itself, even though you have this sort of back and forth involving Chief Justice Warren, never actually engages the issue of race's vagueness, its instability. In fact, the opinion itself says there was never any dispute about Richard and Mildred falling into the category of white and black. So, should we be loving a little less because Warren, knowing all that he did, having the conversation that he did with the oralists, failed to challenge the lie of race in his opinion? I think it's pretty clear it would have been a great idea, right? A great thing for him to stand up and to say, there is no center here, right? There is no substance to the idea of race. The court's equal protection doctrine does that implicitly in holding that racial categories, racial decision making is presumptively unconstitutional. But there's no direct engagement with that, no open acknowledgement. And I think that is a loss. I think Staples is correct in that. Having said that, it's not clear to me that some engagement with that issue in the opinion would have eliminated the problems that we still have around sort of the stain of race, the longevity of biological race. Today, I think it's pretty clear to scientists, think about the Human Genome Project, everyone will say there's no such thing as race. And yet, you'll see constant in medicine, in social science research, references to a sort of biologized, geneticized conception of race. Kiara Bridges has written about this in a very powerful way. Addressing first the social science research, but also looking at the staying power of race in the court's own cases, in particular Title VII cases, and she also talks about the treatment of Native Americans. So Staples isn't wrong, but I think if there's anything to lament, it might be that the court did not say more about the notion of equality that it was trying to map, and the challenge that white supremacy posed to it. The line about in the Loving opinion that uses the term white supremacy is probably one of the most often quoted in legal scholarship. But the court even with that, even with the inclusion of that, I'll just beg to differ with Catherine just a little bit, I think does not fully engage with the problem. The court wanted, obviously, and I think that Dean Chemerinsky was correct in this, wanted to go farther than it had in Brown, and that language helps to sort of carve out a notion of equality that is more capacious than what we get, that is not as limited to education as the Brown case was. But I think it doesn't go far enough. Having said that, I know I'm going to get in trouble because I'm going over my time, but I want to share this with you because I think it's important. To fully understand what Chief Justice Warren was doing with the white supremacy language, I think you have to read the Loving decision directly in connection with Brown and its aftermath. Loving says that the strong version of equality extends beyond the school. I think it also means to focus us in the marriage context, but also on other areas. And I want to just read again something from the oral argument that I think is useful. Okay, I know I'm out. I'm almost done. Chief Justice Warren at one point, again, talking with Virginia's lawyer, who's making the argument that, hey, we states have had the power to regulate marriage time immemorial, right? We've been using these anti-miscegenation statutes. What's the problem with this? And Warren says, he says this, the states that you're talking about, the 16 states that still have anti-miscegenation provisions on the books, says those happen to be the same 16 states that had school segregation laws. Do they not? And I think for him, there's a moment, maybe he was thinking after having the colloquy around race, the fallacy of race, maybe I'll throw that in there. But he gets here, and I felt like I was sort of transported to the courtroom. And you can just see him stop and say, there's a direct line, right, between what's happening here and so much of what we've tried to do in Brown, but in the aftermath of Brown. So where am I going with this ultimately? I think I want to say this, that the real problem with the Loving decision is not that there's a failure to engage the problem of understanding race as biology is socially constructed. The real problem with the decision is offering up white supremacy in a way that had the potential to account for what happened in the past and to speak to a new moment in time without giving it real content, right? The language is powerful because we hadn't seen it before, but it is so anemic. And I think if we're gonna do something with that phrase, that concept today, that what we're going to have to do is to theorize white supremacy in a way that I think those of us in the Legal Academy, including those of us who write about race, have failed to do. We have no response to what, or not an adequate response, I think, to what happened here in Charlottesville. We have lots of sniping between Ta-Nehisi Coates and Cornel West, but not enough substance here. So this is what I suggest, and I'll do it quickly. I think we have to look much more deeply at interlocking systems of domination and to acknowledge that there never was a sort of synchronically uniform or static state here. We have to look globally and to recognize that white supremacy doesn't only exist in the United States, that it exists outside our borders. I think we have to look relationally and intersectionally to understand that white supremacy was very much about gender. The Bureau of Statistics here in Virginia would send out letters to white women who are thought to have given birth to interracial children to say that you cannot pass your child off as white. They were literally policing them through regulatory action. And then I think, so we have to think about gender. We have to think about heterosexualism as well. And then finally, I think we need to think systematically in terms of structures that produce inequality and to look at the ways in which structures that are like marriage, for example, right? So housing, education, but also family-based structures like marriage work to perpetuate inequality. Okay, I'll stop.
Thank you. Thank you.
Wow, wasn't that provocative? We have time for just a couple of questions. I would very much like to entertain all of them, but because we're short on time, will the panel stay around after to talk with people if they have questions? The first one from my colleague, Professor. Any student questions? Professor Masri, would you get us started?
Thank you, panel. A question for Professor Kennedy. Does your analysis suggest that had the court ruled as it did in Loving through the name case earlier, that it would likely have been met with massive resistance? And if so, was the court proving to sort of duck it down?
Yeah. So, yes, I think that if the court had invalidated anti-miscegenation laws in 1956 using name versus name as a vehicle, I think, yes, there would have been, first of all, that we were already, there was already resistance, but would that have upped it? Would that have upped the ante? Yes, I think it would have upped the ante. For one thing, remember, in 1956, there were many more states that had anti-miscegenation laws than in 1967. So it would have been a bigger deal. It would have been not only the invalidation of anti-miscegenation laws in the southern states, but also in states outside of the South. So I think it would have, yes, I think there would have been much more resistance. And here I guess I differ with Dean Chemerinsky. Dean Chemerinsky thought that the Supreme Court showed a sort of a lack of nerve, a lack of courage in ducking the issue in 1956. To me, it's a political question totally. I don't see why one would applaud. Let's suppose the Supreme Court had invalidated anti-miscegenation laws and it would have led to a resistance that would have actually overcome the anti-discrimination project. Would that have been a good thing? Well, the Supreme Court would have, you know, showed courage, I suppose. But in my view, the Supreme Court of the United States is one of the, it's a political institution, just like the, you know, just like the legislative branch, just like the executive branch. And I judge the court on, you know, is the society better off with whatever decisions that it reaches. So frankly, I think that the court was acting prudently, and I applaud its prudence. It was terrible, of course, and there were people, I mean, let's be real, let's understand, there were people in prison in 1956 and who stayed in prison after 1956 because the Supreme Court of the United States ducked it, but Chief Justice Warren and his colleagues, the way that they were thinking about this, how do we transform the United States? Do we want to overstep? Do we want to risk toppling the boat through backlash, it seems to me that was a proper way to think about it.
Or at least comment, right? I'm not sure I agree, I want to say proper, but we can see other areas. Think about Roe versus Wade, that first we had a Griswold, we want to talk about contraception, then we have an Eisenstadt, so we want to talk about not married people, but unmarried, and then we get to Roe. A Lawrence, a Windsor, before we get to Obergefell. So certainly common, I would agree.
Yeah, this is a question for everybody, but particularly for Professor Mark.
Louder, please.
Okay. My question, I think one of the things that's probably most impressive about Loving the Aesthetic was a unanimous decision, and that gives the decision a lot of weight. And if Chief Justice Warren would have taken a stance that race is more of a social construct, do you think you would have been able to get a majority, one, and two, if you would not have achieved a majority, if this would have affected the impact of Loving?
As it was, I think he had a hard time, getting 9 people to support his opinion. So already we have Potter Stewart, who's sort of doing his own thing in a concurrence to separate his own position. So I think that's right? As a practical matter, I think it would have been hard for him to get a majority. It was also hard for him, if you look at the opinion, the second part of the opinion that talks about due process is just really, really tiny. So really short. So why is that? So I have the papers from Justice Warren. I got them recently from the Library of Congress. And because I'm a nerd, I was just sort of pouring through them last night. And there's a note. There's a note from Justice Black who says, can you please move that liberty stuff to a different section? I'll be much more likely to join if you do that. And so I think there was a lot of sort of worry about the fundamental right piece of this and the idea that you're sort of expanding fundamental rights in a problematic way. But I think he also saw that to leave it in as one part would have been to advance a much more capacious understanding of equality than I think came out of that case, and that I think much more capacious than we have today. You almost never see a discussion about dignity or autonomy or liberty when you're talking about race in the court's cases. It's not part of the conversation. Equality, sure, but not dignity. And I think sort of leaving those parts of the opinion together might have sort of created a conversation about that didn't take place in the way that I think it could have.
Could I say something about unanimity? I think unanimity is oversold. When people talk about Brown versus Board of Education, they talk about Warren and what he did to get a unanimous court, and there are lots of very important Supreme Court decisions that were 5-4. I mean, when people say the court, it's five votes, and you've got the court. Now you have dissents, but I mean, if one were to just think about all of American constitutional law and go down the row of cases in which you had 2 dissenters or 3 dissenters or frankly 4, there'd be a lot of important cases. But so my own sense is that people make too much of the of unanimity, and my sense is that sometimes the justices in the majority have given up too much for the sake of unanimity.
I'm going to use the prerogative of the moderator to address a question first to you, Professor Franke, and then to the rest of the group. We are really familiar with the notion and the experience of having efforts that were intended initially to fight white supremacy, to achieve racial equality, being, let's say, diverted towards other important missions, and ultimately not serving the dismantling of the very initial enterprise. We can think of affirmative action, right, which has primarily benefited white women, and we know now that 67% or more of white women oppose affirmative action. And now we see, based on the very intriguing comments of this panel, the same kind of, I'm going to be provocative and say co-opting of the mission initially set out for Loving, going in similar sideways directions. Having read your work, I see a recommendation that we chuck the notion of marriage entirely. Non-marriage is what Professor Lenhardt calls it. And I'm wondering if the fact that African Americans thought of marriage as so important immediately after the civil rights movement, you write about that yourself, that is being forgotten and maybe sacrificed by the recommendations that in order to achieve marriage equality, we eliminate marriage altogether. Are we repeating that same dangerous pattern of taking what was initially to help achieve a defeat of white supremacy and diverting it in a way that might entrench it?
It's a good thing my plane doesn't leave till tomorrow morning. That's a big set of questions. I suppose the answer is yes. The one way to understand the bundle of things that you suggest in your questions is to return to what Professor Lenhardt began with, which is the best way to dismantle power, to dismantle the institutions that become the containers for structural power, whether it's race itself, marriage, heterosexuality. We can think of lots of institutions that are the sites where power sort of coagulates in ways that benefit some and harm others. And should that be your starting point, or should that be where you end? And those are just difficult, vexing questions, for which I don't know that there are right answers, but I think asking the question in interesting ways, as Professor Lenhardt did in her remarks and some of our other work, as has Professor Kennedy in his work, is so much the problem of a postmodern period of so often people of color and others ask, is it fair to dismantle the category when we have never had a modern period of enjoyment of the category? No, of course it's not. But we need to have parallel projects going on at once, I think, where we at once recognize the work that the category does, while we also tolerate, if you will, those who feel that their time is not up yet of enjoying the category, a category an institution into which they were not granted admission for so many years. So I struggle with it in wedlocked. I think these are profoundly difficult questions in really all aspects of society, but what better group than this to chew on those questions? So, thank you. But that's the answer from white women.
I'd like to speak in all praise of co-optation. I think that one of the great glories of the struggle for racial justice in American history has been that the struggle for racial justice in American history has been the seedbed of all the other struggles. If one takes a look at, when in the slavery regime, abolitionism, the women's voice, suffragists found their voice, found their themes, found their imagery in the struggle against slavery. The Second Reconstruction, if one takes a look at in every imaginable instance and phase or domain of American history,
Just one right quick. We're at a public university. I want to ask the question, where did students first get federal constitutional rights of due process, of freedom of speech? The Second Reconstruction, black students in the Deep South, Dixon versus Alabama State College. And that story can be repeated, that story can be repeated time after time after time. So I think it's a wonderful thing when lesbians, gays, take the imagery, take the songs, take the thinking of the black struggle and use it for their purposes. And this, I think that's wonderful. I have no complaint against that. I think that's one of the great things about people struggling in general. It's like a baton. One struggle for justice, one struggle for freedom, seeds another struggle for freedom. And that's why my hat is off to all people who struggle for freedom and justice.
Can I just say, underscore that and add just one thing? I thought Professor Frankie might say this too. I think co-optation can be an opportunity for reflection too on the stories that we tell ourselves. And I think the story about marriage, for example, for African Americans is much more complicated than people allow. That it was a story about regulation and oppression and subjugation for many groups, Native Americans, African Americans. I write about Puerto Ricans as well and their history. And so, and then sort of looking at it now, yes, we can get into it, but many people can't, for structural reasons, I think, really access it. They don't end up marrying in rates that you might expect, even though the rates for everyone are going down. And I think that sort of the conversation that you laid out from the perspective of a white lady, as you said, I think that we should add to that we need to get our stories correct in the first instance sometimes. And I think the story that those who complain about co-optation have around race and marriage is not, it's not necessarily correct. It's at least incomplete, and you've made that very clear in your work, and I hope in the book that's coming out, I'm assuming in the book that's coming out as well. Mm-hmm.
So that now we are agreed that co-optation is to be praised. What do we...
Wait, we're not in agreement on that.
I wonder what the urgency or the response to the urgency of the remaining racial mission should be. You, Professor Lenhart, gave us some, I think, provocative action steps that we could look at. In response to, for example, the kind of clip that we see, the kind of dangerous supremacy of a great white nation that is emerging. What should be the response, do you think, in order to make that co-optation complete so that we are all together not only seeding missions but accomplishing the dismantling of white supremacy?
Oh, that's a question for me.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, for everyone. I mean, so I wouldn't describe that as a moment of co-optation, right? And I should quibble with it, that term a little bit too, but I see it more as an opportunity for engagement, for solidarity, for identifying types, similarities in forms of domination. And so I would like to see an approach and understanding of white supremacy that places race at the center, but that is clear-eyed about the ways in which ideas of race, of the stigma that attaches to race, are connected to other forms of domination. I mentioned gender. So you don't get blackness and whiteness in Virginia without somebody policing what white women are doing in their bedrooms and with whom they're doing that. Without the terrorizing of black men
and lynching of black men as a way, using violence as a way to regulate intimate connections. So I think that I want a race and white supremacy center, but in a way that brings in others who are not just for kumbaya purposes, as my dad would say, you're just a kumbaya, you know, person, but really in ways that are linked up to the power structures and hierarchies that are operating in this context. Okay. Thank
you. This is going to sound very naive.
Just a little louder.
Question. So I'm not going to try to answer the whole question, but one idea is I think we need to move to a point of being able to allow people to have the autonomy to select their own racial ethnic identity. I mean, when this young lady is reading off 137, 136. I mean, and the irony of it for me is this: my understanding that Mildred Jeter Loving was actually a member of a First Peoples tribe, the Rappahannock, here in Virginia, which, given pop culture, I don't know if that's accurate, but it's my understanding, was totally ignored. And the Racial Equality and Integrity Act ignored many nuances and differences among people that should be well respected.
Professor Kennedy, would you respond? That's pop culture, but I think pretty accurate.
Yeah, the whole question of, it's come up time and again this morning, you know, the question of who is who. And of course, as a legal matter, our courts have very often run away from that issue. Professor Linhart mentioned that in the racial covenant cases, the issue arose. In the anti-miscegenation cases, the cases arose. The cases, I mean, there are actually hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases that adjudicate racial identification. We don't think of them anymore because the Jim Crow laws have been buried. But during the period that the Jim Crow laws were in existence, I mean, imagine if you were part of a couple and the couple was charged with violating anti-miscegenation law. One line of defense was, we're not violating the anti-miscegenation laws because we're both of the same race. Well, then if the district attorney thought something different, he said, well, no, she's white. Well, how do you know she's white? And then you'd have briefs on that. So there are actually hundreds of cases in which juries and judges have had to, you know, reach determinations as to who was who. Currently, we basically have, I think, a system that's close to the one that you want, actually. So currently, we basically have a system of self-identification. When you get a thing from the census and you check it, you don't have to worry about somebody coming up and, you know, slamming you in jail because you said that you were white and the census taker said, no, you're colored. You can identify yourself the way you want. Similarly, with respect to schools, initially, when affirmative action was first coming down the pike, folks thought that it would be one of the ways in which this would be a tremendous problem. Well, you know, just suppose people, quote, cheat. Just suppose people try to take advantage of affirmative action. Just suppose white people try to take advantage of affirmative action by saying that they are people of color. Now, interestingly enough, this has not happened very much. Question, why hasn't it happened very much? I mean, my own little pet theory is that it hasn't happened that much because actually people sort of feared marking themselves down as colored. I mean, they did a sort of a hard calculation and figured, well, you know, I might get a little bit of a momentary benefit, but if it's later found out and people actually believe I'm colored, there'll be a more of a detriment. But my point is that actually the issue that you mention actually has come up in the legal regime, and what you actually want is pretty close to what we have. Now, in social relations, it's a little bit different, so that you had that the lady who was the NAACP official who held herself out as a woman of color, And then, you know, her parents said, well, no, she's white. And then a lot of people got mad at her. So in social relations, I think there really is a disciplining. People don't like the idea of people changing their racial identities and, you know, saying who they are in a way that would be in conflict with what, you know, sort of prevailing social norms would ascribe, you know, the identity of someone. But as a legal matter, I think what you want has largely come to pass.
I think this is also a place where you might look to recent transgender activism that many trans advocates are arguing. It's up to me, not a medical official or the state, to decide what my real gender identity is. And that is, I think, underlays the argument that Gavin Grimm made to the Supreme Court, is I am a real boy, and I should be treated as a real boy in school, particularly with respect to bathrooms, but not only. And that's up to me to decide, not the school district. Part of the problem with that is that autonomy norm that you prize remains invested in the categories. And I have found Gavin's argument and the ACLU's argument in that case really problematic because it presupposes realness and that there are things that are boys and there are things that are real girls. And there are other trans advocates who want to blow up those categories entirely and not have us have to pick which box we properly fit into, whether it's the state doing the picking or I get to do the picking. So if we want a world that is conjured by Professor Lenhardt's presentation where we actually don't care because these are fictions, do we want to say the same thing about sexual or gender identity as we do about race? And will we always be in a society that stratifies people based on identity so long as those categories exist? And, you know, these are those hard questions.
But I don't think I'll pause here. We'll put a pause here. Did I interrupt your thought? I want to make sure.
No, I have lots of thoughts.
Okay.
Thankfully.
So we've talked about supremacy, we've talked about resistance, we've talked about dignity and so much more this morning. This has just been the beginning. I hope you'll stay for the rest of the program. Thank me, yes. Join me, please, in thanking this amazing panel.